Bring in Leo Sazdi, he's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government in an attempt to put an end to the country's 13-month political deadlock. Prime Minister Najib Mirati's list of ministers, which consists of 24 members, includes many technocrats. Lebanon has been headed by a caretaker government since Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned in the wake of the catastrophic Beirut port explosion in August 2020, which killed over 200 people. Since then, Lebanese political groups had failed to resolve their differences. Fuel shortages in Lebanon have forced businesses and government offices to close, threatening to cause blackouts at hospitals and halt transportation. The crisis has been exacerbated by U.S. sanctions as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs. First joining us on tonight's program, we have our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mariam, if you're with us, tell us about the significance of the political developments in Lebanon right now.
Well, it is very important. However, it is not the only step that should be taken. This is just the first step ahead in the 1,000 miles that we need to take in order for us to resolve the crisis in Lebanon. Of course, this government on its own cannot resolve the crisis. We heard also from the European Union stressing to the new government that they know their first job, their first duty, which is the long overdue reforms that need to be taken by the Lebanese government in order to deserve, as they say, new funds that are coming in. Of course, that would be perhaps the first reaction from foreign sides. We also have congratulations from other countries. However, they're all eyeing this government specifically. Now, we did not see, of course, people very much with high hopes, because what they want to see is that they can find and provide for their families on a daily basis, that the price of the dollar is not as high as it reached in the last few months. They want to be able to take their kids to school. They want to be able to provide medication for the ill. So these are just basic needs that we're looking at, in addition to the fuel crisis, with what's happening in hospitals and schools that are also, of course, threatened not opening. So these are some of the things that Prime Minister Najib Mikati mentioned himself. And he said that, "I will knock on all doors. I will not leave a stone unturned without trying to, of course, doing my best in order to help resolve the crisis with the team that he has put together in accordance with, of course, President Michel Aoun." Of course, although these are newcomers, they're not politicized. They don't belong directly to political groups. However, they were endorsed by different political factions because it is necessary to have that endorsement in order to ensure that there will be confidence for the government so the government can do its job. We will be seeing perhaps in the next week a meeting by the parliament to study the cabinet manifesto and to see if they can provide a vote of confidence for this cabinet in what time it has left in order for it to be able to do something to uplift this crisis, or at least put in a salvation plan, if we may say.
All right, thanks a lot. Mariam Saleh joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Let's take a look at the guests that we have for tonight's show. And journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's start off with Mr. Magni in Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Elijah, what are some of the immediate challenges for the new government in Lebanon?
Hello, and thank you for having me. I think Miriam summarized very well the situation in Lebanon. And what is obvious is there are no miracles to be expected from this government. And around 20 out of 24 are linked directly to the political parties and decision maker in the country. So when we're talking about the political reforms, it's going to be quite difficult to reform a country when we have the election coming up next year and the same people are ruling again in the country. So basically, facing the challenges of the daily life needs and the basic daily life needs, like no electricity, no gasoline, and no diesel, the winter is coming, devaluation of the local currency, there is a free fall of everything in the country. People are migrating from Lebanon and trying to look for better life or at least a decent life, because it can't be worse for the people in Lebanon who are not used to this kind of life ever before, even during the civil war in 1975 and the Israeli war. They lived a better life than it is today. So I don't think there are a high expectation. The devaluation of the lira stopped for a few, 24 hours, but I don't think it's going to remain going down and gaining. The Lebanese lira are not going to continue gaining over the dollar because there is no money in the country. And the foreign countries are saying, well, start with your reforms first, and then we can supply you with money or with support, but that is always conditioned. So is it going to privatize everything in a country when people can't afford their daily life and their basic needs? That's going to be a very big challenge for the new government.
Said Mohsen Abbas, a lot of talk about reforms for a new government in Lebanon. What are, in your opinion, the most urgent reforms a future government has to tackle?
Well, I think the most urgent reform is that nations like Lebanon, like Iran, like Syria, those nations which are constantly sanctioned by the United States and by the money mafia around the world, first of all, they need to start thinking about resistance economies rather than constantly relying on the dollar-linked, what I call neoliberal economies. And this has been what the fundamental problem for Lebanon has really been, is that they were tied in by their head of the central bank, Mr. Salame, into the dollar to the extent where, you know, everything is basically beholden to the Americans. And of course, given the political significance of Lebanon, insofar as Hezbollah and the clash with Israel is concerned, and the broader involvement of the U.S. in the Middle East, of course, then this becomes a playground for what I call the Anglo-Zionist Empire to take hold of. I mean, they don't fundamentally, first of all, want a Lebanon that is strong, unified, and that can stand and resist Israel, for a start. Secondly, they have their own puppets within the country. Of course, there's a large number of politicians and factions around the Hariri camp in particular, which are which would much rather be with Americans and the Saudis, etc. So there is a collision of ideologies as well going on here, political ideologies. But of course, when the whole Salame strategy of tying to the dollar collapsed, what you had was, of course, the impact on the street and the crowds that gathered to try to get the government to move to create ease for them, given all the financial hardships and their lack of access to the dollars that they essentially had tied up in those banks. The Western powers, the Anglo-Zionist empire, smelt blood, so they fermented even more of those problems at that time. And alongside that strategy of trying to blame Hezbollah for all of this economic crisis, which is clearly what the Americans did at that time, and their proxies inside Lebanon. They also followed through Trump's administration a policy of tightening the economic noose further by making negotiations with the International Monetary Fund the only option for the government to receive any kind of relief, on the condition, of course, that reforms must be first implemented, which they're still, of course, pushing. So, you know, no one questions the need for deep and structural change in the Lebanese economy, but the IMF's usual fare, as we know, of austerity and privatization, it often results essentially in countries falling deeper into a cycle of debt and dependency. So while they might want to go down the lines that these the international powers are saying to them, that won't necessarily rescue their economy or Lebanon.
Elijah Magnier, in the past, Hezbollah has warned that the U.S. had been responsible for obstructing efforts to form a government. What were Washington's motives in that regard, and will such disruptive efforts continue now?
The U.S. motive at the beginning for the first couple of years since 2019 was to cripple the Lebanese economy and to turn the population against Hezbollah, and so they can consider that it is because Hezbollah has weapons, deterrence weapons against Israel, this is the cause of all the troubles of the country. Therefore, Hezbollah needs to be disarmed. What happened is the Lebanese were very much aware that all the friends of the U.S. are the one accused of corruption who ruled the country since 1990. And it is not Hezbollah who is responsible for the corruption and the crisis in the country. Moreover, what happened is that when Hezbollah said, the Hezbollah leader said, Hassan Nasrallah, said that he's not going to allow the population to starve, and at least a society that protects the party and also the allies of Hezbollah. And this is when the threat has turned into an opportunity, and Hezbollah asked Iran to supply food first, second, medical supply, and a third, the oil tanker. When the U.S. saw that their sanctions are mainly affected their own people, and then Hezbollah and Iran are benefiting from the sanctions imposed on Syria and in consequences on Iran, on Lebanon, then they realize that what they are doing is to fall into the hand of Iran and Hezbollah by reinforcing the Hezbollah-Iran camp in Lebanon and giving another opportunity for the axis of the resistance to use this opportunity and to supply the Lebanese population and to see, to show the Lebanese population the difference between the American and their allies' behavior toward Lebanon and Iran and its allies' behavior toward the population. And this is what turned everything upside down and pushed the U.S. ambassador in Beirut to say, well, wait a minute, we can supply you with gas coming from Egypt. And what happened is today we have the Americans working very hard to bring the gas from Egypt, and that's going to take 6 to 8 months. On the other hand, the Iranian tankers are not going to stop. So what they have done is they have provided more ammunition, if we can say, and more elements for Iran and Hezbollah to grow their popularity among the population.
Said Mohsen Abbas, when the U.S. warned Beirut about obtaining fuel from Iran, the counter offer that Washington had, which was importing fuel from Egypt and electricity from Jordan via Syria, which itself is under U.S. sanctions, did that make any sense at all?
Well, Syria is sanctioned from supplying anything, so it doesn't make any sense. But this is the nature of the American imperialist policy in the Middle East. It makes no sense. It makes no sense to the U.S. in terms of its economic prosperity, but it's primarily obviously serving the interests of the wider Israeli Yinon plan in that region, and it's committed to that due to all the Israeli lobbies and their long-standing links. So we all know this, that the U.S. is not really calling the shots on the policy around the Middle East. We know that Tel Aviv and Israel are pushing for anything that happens with its neighbors, and the U.S. Senators and the Congress basically say amen, no matter what that policy is, no matter how diabolically harmful it is to the Americans. So the U.S. economic sanctions, let's just take that as one example of the absolute stupidity, really, of this policy trying to attack Lebanon or even take on the axis of the resistance. You've got, no matter how smart, essentially, Washington claims themselves to be, they rarely, if ever, brought down the targeted regime or group, because that's what they're trying to do in Lebanon. They want to bring down the regime that might have a deference to Hezbollah or supports them, of course, the Christian Maronites, the Amal group, and Hezbollah and others are united in trying to keep the Americans from basically engineering their society and controlling Lebanon. So they're fighting essentially for the independence and sovereignty of Lebanon. But in most recent cases where the U.S. has tried this business of targeted sort of regime change, it's had the opposite effect. And as Elijah was saying earlier, really, it highlights the fact that it simply strengthens the hand of the state that is in power, basically by impoverishing the population and making it more dependent on the government and its support and assistance. So one only has to even look at the 13-year international economic blockade against Iraq and Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait. And there are many, many other examples of this. You know, they've constantly done it. But they must really think again and understand that economic sanctions won't work. Military, if you like, bullying won't work in that region. It's a new West Asia, and if they could only get away from the grip of Israel and actually coordinate a policy of justice and fairness in the region, okay, they might still stand a chance of salvaging some sort of economic link there eventually.
Mr. Abbas, allow me to intervene here, jump in for a second. This is for you as well. Amidst the fuel and energy crisis, how come no Arab country has offered assistance to Lebanon to alleviate some of the pressure that the nation is experiencing right now?
Well, the Arab nations that you talk about are essentially puppet proxies. I mean, we've seen the whole Abraham Accords and the sort of the whole Trump era efforts to essentially normalize Israel, and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have openly done so. The Saudis have also all but done it in name. I mean, they're behind the scenes collaborating, cooperating in every way that you could possibly imagine. So essentially, these Arab governments are ruled by individuals who have been brought to power by the Anglo-Zionist Empire and are maintained by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. They financially support the siphoning of most of the wealth of that region into real estate and other investments and Swiss bank accounts. That's their primary purpose, leaving those countries essentially just as actually, from a manufacturing and from a stability point of view, just as weak as they were before the Anglo-Zionist Empire essentially took over the reins.
Right.
So it's nothing from them. Those powers will only move if they think that Iran, as it's doing, has a chance of having too much of a hold on Lebanon. Then it's a possibility, as you can see, that they are forced to come in and try and play a brinksmanship game there.
Mr. Magni, regionally, who benefits from uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
The Americans and Israel benefit from the instability in Lebanon, because that will turn the attention of the axis of the resistance domestically, rather than protecting the borders and preventing Israel from fiddling with the American borders and trying to steal the wealth energy of the country. This is something that we've seen also in Syria, which is exactly the same, because Lebanon has only borders with Syria, and the instability in both countries is essential for what the Americans call the safety of Israel. So this is what they've tried hard in the past in different ways, by waging war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, by dividing Syria, and by allowing the Takfiri to rule. Now they try the economic sanction, and this is where they are failing, because as I said, the opportunity came, and the Americans fell into their own trap by removing temporarily the Caesar Act on Syria and allowing it to import the gas from Egypt. So the instability that the U.S. is looking forward to have in Lebanon and Syria is really empowering Syria and Lebanon at the end of the day.
And Mr. Abbas, let's turn our attention to the round after round of U.S. sanctions. These sanctions haven't called an act of aggression against all of Lebanon. Why is the United States piling the pressure on the Lebanese people, on all of Lebanon, when the nation is so obviously suffering?
Well, they intended to do it on the actual section of the establishment which was in support of Hezbollah, or was actually standing for the sovereignty of Lebanon, as far as I can see. But that has backfired. The fact is that there were billions of dollars of debt which were there, not because of the fault of the Lebanese people, but actually due to the civil war, and the money that was injected after the civil war. That money was, let's face it, there was a huge kind of set of corrupt individuals and organizations that have had to essentially divide the pie. Now, that's just a legacy which Lebanon has been left with, but it's been compounded by the IMF and the kind of Americans and all of these forces, which basically want Lebanon to bend its knee to essentially Israel. That's what they're trying to persuade, and they're doing everything in their powers, but it's failing. It seems to me that the axis of resistance has got the upper hand. In Lebanon, I cannot see these economic sanctions working. The more they do them, the more the population will turn against the Americans and their stooges in Lebanon. And as soon as the stooges find that the heat is coming on them, you'll find that they'll soon start dropping their kind of the policies they're trying to roll out there. But the Lebanese people are intelligent people. They will see through most of the situation. I think Hezbollah and Saeed Nasrallah is playing a very formidable hand in all this, and the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is there on every level, and I think they're just waiting for the word just as to how much support Lebanon requires. Of course, Lebanon should look east, because beyond Iran there is China, of course there's Russia and the Eurasian axis. This is the game in the Middle East that is going on now, that these nations need to cut free from the slavery imposed by the Anglo-Zionist empire economically, and they need to find new ways of surviving, new economies, resistance economies that are not linked to the Anglo-Zionists.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. That was journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnia joining us from Brussels, also journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas speaking to us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back, so stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَفَلَمْ يَدَّبَّرُوا الْقَوْلَ أَمْ جَاءَهُمْ مَا لَمْ يَأْتِ آبَاءَهُمُ الْأَوَّلِينَ
Then have they not reflected over the Quran? Or has there come to them that which had not come to their forefathers?
The 68th verse of the chapter says, أَفَلَمْ يَدَّبَّرُوا الْقَوْلَ أَمْ جَاءَهُمْ مَا لَمْ يَأْتِ آبَاءَهُمُ الْأَوَّلِينَ Have they not pondered over the statement of the Quran? Or has anything come to them that did not come to their fathers of old? Dear listeners, you may remember the former holy verses spoke about the excuses that the unbelievers brought to justify their deeds, and the verses also spoke about the answer to them. Now, these verses from 68th to 70th verse are concisely showing five real reasons why the unbelievers shunned the truth. The first is this verse. Have they not pondered over the statement? أَفَلَمْ يَدَّبَّرُوا الْقَوْلِ Now, the previous verses were about the unbelievers' opposition against the Prophet ﷺ. And in this verse, the first cause of their misery is mentioned. The first cause is that they did not think and ponder over the content of the Prophet's call. If they hadn't do so, their problems would no longer have existed. So, as the verse is clearly suggesting, the first cause of a people's misfortune and misery is because they cease to think, because they stop reflecting. And not only is the Holy Quran a book for recitation, but it is a book for contemplation and reflection as well. And anyone who will ponder over its words will discover its profound truths. And we have experienced that throughout the history. We have seen many instances of the people who have heard only one or a couple of verses of the Holy Quran, and by merely listening to those verses, they have come to be from amongst the believers. So the first part of this verse says, أَفَلَمْ يَدَّبَّرُوا الْقَوْلِ Have they not pondered over the statement of the Holy Quran? And then the second reason is explained. أَمْ جَاءَهُمْ مَا لَمْ يَأْتِ أَبَاءَهُمُ الْأَوَّلِينَ Or has anything come to them that did not come to their fathers of old? Means that the thoughts and also the words of the prophets have been existing throughout the history for all different generations and people.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
This indicates that when the Prophet ﷺ had invited them to the belief in the unity of Allah and the so-called monotheism, the belief in the resurrection and to good deeds and purity, they would make excuses that these were ideas too novel for them to accept, and that's why they stopped following the thoughts of the Prophet. And they further claimed that if the thoughts had been true, Allah, who is merciful to all human beings, would have revealed them to their ancestors as well. But when we consider the fact that the Prophet's message is the same in principle and origin, and it has been the same throughout all the previous prophets, this excuse becomes devoid of meaning. This could be an indicative of the previous verses, specifically the 66th one, where the Almighty Allah said, قَدْ كَانَتْ آيَاتِ تُتْلَى عَلَيْكُمْ. Indeed, my signs used to be rehearsed to you, but you used to turn back on your heels, which means that they were ignoring the prophets, but they were seeking development and progress with that denial, I mean, but rather it caused deterioration. And ignoring the thoughts and teachings of the prophets will cause our downfall. And the last point regarding these couple of verses is that the Almighty Allah is bringing different arguments and different reasonings to stop the excuses of the opposition of the truth. Whenever we are claiming to be the supporters of the right and truth side, we must be having different kinds of reasoning and arguments, both to stop them from misleading us and the others as well. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
World with reporters.
The visit of Qatar's foreign minister is the latest in a series of visits undertaken by foreign dignitaries to Pakistan in recent days. Following the visits of foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, UK and Netherlands, the visit of Qatar's top diplomat also focused on Afghanistan. His visit comes just days after the Afghan Taliban announced an interim government that drew criticism from certain Western countries for ignoring the demands of inclusive setup. Speaking at a joint news conference, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said the immediate priority must be the well-being of the people of Afghanistan.
And the most important thing that we both agree to is that we have to protect the interests of the people of Afghanistan. And for that, their safety, their security, stability, and to ensure that this Afghanistan, you know, does not become an arena for, you know, for proxy wars.
Since the Taliban took over, there have been fears of economic meltdown as the international financial institutions and Western countries suspended the assistance.
Humanitarian situation and the humanitarian assistance should be independent from any political progress, because we believe that the Afghan people deserve to be helped, deserve to be supported, despite what's happening in the political landscape.
The Qatari foreign minister said the inclusive government is important for the unity of Afghanistan. The interim government announced by the Taliban was contrary to the commitment they made earlier that the political dispensation would be inclusive and broad-based. The interim government is set to take oath on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 attacks in the United States. Many countries are closely watching the Taliban whether they live up to the promises. But Pakistan and Qatar maintain that the world community should not take any steps that may aggravate the problems for the people of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as the Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates escaped Jalbu prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Jalbu prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jilbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army.
Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The British government has come under renewed condemnation after failing to honour their pledge to define Islamophobia 2 years after making the initial promise. With MPs and critics all condemning the lack of action amid rising Islamophobia across the UK, an all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims created their own definition of Islamophobia in 2018, describing it as a form of racism.
Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Regardless which political group makes the definition, grassroots British Muslim groups are concerned over what they see as an establishment-pushed definition.
The best case scenario for this definition of Islamophobia would be one that forces the government to critically self-reflect and critically analyse its policies and policies of previous governments that have led to Islamophobia. I do specifically mean the so-called counter-extremism policies, which have just been a thinly veiled excuse to surveil the Muslim community. And these policies have had such detrimental impacts on the mental and physical well-being of the Muslim community. It's so likely we're going to have a watered-down definition that is nothing more than empty words. Why? Because there's been no engagement with the grassroots of society. There's been no engagement with organisations like ours, like MPAC UK, or CAGE, or MEND, or, critically, active masajid like Lewisham Islamic Centre. There's been no engagement with organisations like these which have had to deal with the mess created by 20 years of suspicion and policies and institutionalized Islamophobia.
Some have already begun to adopt the definition, including the opposition Labour Party. However, accusations of Islamophobia within Labour remain, despite its implementation.
A lot of scepticism still surrounds this definition, with many fearing that it will ultimately fail to serve the community effectively, if at all. However, while MPs continue to procrastinate on the issue, Islamophobia remains a very real and persistent threat on both a street and systemic level. Robert Carter, London.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar al-Balad in Dar'a city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. 9 checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya Police Department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area.
Today, Dar al-Balad returns to Syria with efforts of people and security forces. Reconciliation talks have been successful. The armed forces and police have entered the town and 9 security checkpoints have been established.
The government's control over Dar al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Dar al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam Quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Dar'a. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Dar'a al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict like the one here in Dar al-Balad.
حمد علي درع البلد southern Syria.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people. Our hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A civilian maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says financial problems.
We are Sabreen Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are before we received oil from the WHO during 2021. The amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth. The amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many child and woman, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only three oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the Islamic Saudi war and the blockade. Yemen has also blamed the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continued Saudi violations of their rights. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
French President Macron announced recently that the Operation Barkhane in the Sahel region, especially in Mali, will be reshaped before the end of the year. Barkhane is a French military operation that started in 2014 in five Sahel countries, Mauritania, Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad and Mali, officially to fight against Al-Qaeda and Daesh-affiliated groups. In the beginning, French officials considered it as a success, but 7 years later, they admit that they have failed. Macron blames the Sahel states for the failure.
We cannot secure regions sliding back into lawlessness because the states decide not to take the responsibilities. That's impossible.
But are the Sahel states the only ones to blame? Is the stalemate in Mali not the result of the failure of French neocolonial policy in the region? Fact is that years after the French military intervention began, Mali is today divided in two, with the Malian state very little present in the north, where radical rebel groups control large parts of the country. So why did France intervene?
France has decided to intervene in the Sahel and in Mali to preserve its influence in the region. The French diplomacy was convinced that the status of France in the UN Security Council depended from the support of the Sahel countries. It guaranteed France of almost 30 extra votes in the UN General Assembly in support of its diplomacy.
But now France is getting bogged down in Mali, titles the monthly newspaper Le Monde Diplomatique. That's why France reshapes its military presence. 2,500 soldiers instead of 5,000. The new operation is called Takuba. Eventually, other European countries may join the French, but they are reluctant. Nobody wants to be humiliated, as the USA have recently been in Afghanistan. The French neocolonial policy in the region is not anymore what it was. The central command of the Takuba Task Force will now be in Niger instead of Mali. That's not a coincidence. Niger has important uranium mines essential to feed the nuclear power plants in France. The Barkhane operation in Mali is coming to its end, but in fact it will continue under another name and by other means with the same hidden goal, to protect the economic interests of France in the region. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jalbo prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Voices of dissent outside Europe's biggest weapons fair, euphemistically called Defense and Security Equipment International, DSEI. More than 37,000 delegates descending on the British capital this year for a close encounter of the military kind, with more than 1,700 companies and dozens of governments here to buy or sell. Some are offering surveillance equipment, other manufacturers marketing all manner of lethal hardware, among them those who profited immensely from the so-called war on terror. The UK claims that it's leading the way in ethical arms sales.
We have a procedure that follows the consolidated criteria that is very clear around humanitarian law. We have in place a rigorous and robust process.
That is a claim dismissed by groups such as Stop the Arms Fair. They say by hosting the weapons show, Britain is perpetuating conflict and putting profit before human lives.
This arms fair wouldn't happen without the UK's support, the government's support. The defence and security exports team of the government makes sure that this arms fair happens. They know that human rights abusing countries are coming here to buy weapons that are made by UK companies and also foreign companies that we host in our country.
Campaigners also point out that several countries specifically invited here, such as the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, are on the UK government's human rights watch list.
The fact that we're hosting such hideous weaponry and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
In recent years, short of 60% of British arms exports have gone to the Middle East, accounting for billions of dollars in sales. Most of that business has gone to Saudi Arabia, which, according to many rights groups, has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes in Yemen.
Since 2015, the UK government has approved hundreds of arms export licenses to Saudi Arabia, worth more than $9 billion. Of that figure, nearly $2 billion came between July and September last year, after a court here rejected a legal challenge to ban weapon sales to the kingdom, a move slammed by critics as immoral.
The UK also sells record amounts of arms to Israel, lending support to Tel Aviv's militarized repression of Palestinians. Campaigners in Britain's political opposition are calling for an immediate change in government policy. But while they point out a shift in public opinion in recent years, the arms fair and the multi-billion dollar worldwide industry that drives it shows every sign of growing. Saeed Pariza, London.
The limelight.
Healthy boys may be more likely to be admitted to hospital with a rare side effect of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine that causes inflammation of the heart than with COVID itself, U.S. researchers have claimed. Their analysis of medical data suggests that boys aged between 12 and 15 with no underlying medical conditions are 4 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with vaccine-related myocarditis than ending up in hospital with COVID over a 4-month period. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's science editor Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Boys More at Risk from Pfizer Jab Side Effect Than COVID, Suggests Study.